taking has aid or consent of any other nation on earth. Upon that issue, we expect to carry every single state in this union.
That is the voice of the 22nd President of the United States. Almost 65 years have passed since Grover Cleveland stood before Edison's amazing little machine and shouted into the horn. Since that time, the technique of sound recording has made miraculous progress. And on this record, you will hear the voices of 11 presidents as they were recorded on wax cylinders, on early discs that still used the acoustical horn method and later the microphone, and finally on magnetic tape, the latest advance in the miracle of recording. A voice once recorded never dies, and each time we play a recorded voice from the past, its owner seems to live again for us. This is a special magic, something that a photograph in a history book can't do. It's this special magic that brings us the living voice of Grover Cleveland now, as he speaks in 1892 during his campaign against Benjamin Harrison, the Republican candidate.
I shall not slander the fair state of Massachusetts nor the state of New York by saying that the people of those states will declare our helpless impotency as a nation to attend to our own business. It is the issue of 1776 over again. Our ancestors, when but 3 million, had the courage to declare their political independence of every other nation upon earth. Now we, their descendants, when we have grown to 70 million, declare that we are less independent than our forefathers? No, my friends, it will never be the judgment of this people.
As campaigns go, the one in 1892 was not a particularly exciting one. Both candidates had already served a term in the White House, Cleveland from 1884 to 1888, Harrison succeeding him and running now for re-election. Both men were well known to the voters. It was a time of industrial expansion for the nation, and there were no earth-shaking issues at stake, save that of governmental spending, which even in a prosperous year made many voters dissatisfied with the Harrison administration. Cleveland sat out the campaign at his home in Buzzards Bay, suffering from the gout and making an occasional speech. Harrison, whose wife had just died, stayed in deep mourning and made almost no public appearances. Cleveland won the election with 277 electoral votes to Harrison's 145. Incidentally, the music you just heard might well have been played at a rally during the Cleveland-Harrison campaign. It's the Hiawatha March, recorded on a cylinder record by the Edison Military Band. Quite a far cry from today's hi-fi. Just as recording techniques have changed since Cleveland's day, so have the methods of conducting political campaigns. Today, through the miracle of radio and television, a candidate can speak to literally millions of voters at once. But for more than the first 100 years of our nation's history, it was considered neither dignified nor in good taste for a candidate to go out and solicit votes in his own behalf. The office was supposed to seek the man, and so it did. The campaign of 1896 changed all that for good. It was one of the most exciting races in history. Shortly after Grover Cleveland took office in 1893, the country was plunged into the most serious depression it had known. Strikes added violence to poverty, and there arose a tidal wave of resentment against the big bosses and the Wall Street moguls. The Republicans chose Governor William McKinley of Ohio as their candidate in 1896. McKinley's great champion, Mark Hanna, the Ohio millionaire and political power, was boss of the Republican Party and actually made the choice, but it was a good one. McKinley was an upright and substantial man and a firm believer in the will of the majority. The Democrats were faced with a more difficult choice, knowing that their party was on shaky political ground. At their convention in Chicago, there was open mutiny as the Free Silver supporters cried for the impeachment of Cleveland as a tool of Wall Street. After a series of boring speakers, William Jennings Bryan, the silver-tongued Nebraskan, rose up to transfix the crowd with a blast against the gold standard that has become a classic. The crowd went completely wild as Brian finished with his memorable words, "You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." There were tears and there were screams of joy as the delegates raised Brian to their shoulders and carried him around the roaring hall. Women fainted, rival delegates embraced one another, and the Democrats knew that they had found a leader. Brian set out immediately on a tour of 29 states, speaking in a little over 3 months before more than 5 million people. He turned loose his bombastic oratory on them in person. Radio and television had not even been dreamed of then, as he traveled 18,000 miles by slow train across the country, whistle stop by whistle stop. William McKinley, on the other hand, didn't travel anywhere. Mark Hanna, Dollar Mark, as he came to be nicknamed, advised him to stay home in Canton, Ohio, and let the people come to him. The people came in delegations of hundreds, sometimes 20 groups a day, and their fares to Canton were all paid by Mark Hanna. Hanna organized a vast campaign machine with professional speakers stumping for McKinley all over the country, with parades and with songs. Millions of pieces of campaign literature were printed, including slips to be put into employees' pay envelopes that read bluntly, "If Brian is elected, do not come back to work. The plant will be closed." Standing on his front porch, McKinley addressed the men who would spread the word in his behalf. His speeches, as his friend John Hay said, were so strong, so varied, so pertinent, so full of facts briefly set forth, of theories embodied in a single phrase, that they formed the hourly text for other speakers of the party. In one of McKinley's front porch speeches, he said,
"My fellow citizens, recent events have imposed upon the patriotic people of this country a responsibility and a duty greater than that of any since the Civil War. Then it was a struggle to preserve the government of the United States. Now it is a struggle to preserve the financial honor of the government. Our creed embraces an honest dollar, an untarnished national credit, adequate revenues for the uses of the government, protection to labor and industry, preservation of the home market, and reciprocity which will extend our foreign market. Upon this platform we stand and submit its declaration to the sober and considerate judgment of the American people."
Gold standard won, and so did McKinley, who polled 500,000 popular votes more than Bryan. 4 years later, in 1900, McKinley beat Bryan again. This time, tradition forbade President McKinley to actively campaign, and the brunt of the race was borne by Theodore Roosevelt. McKinley's second term in the White House was cut short by tragedy. His assassination in 1901 at the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo put Theodore Roosevelt into the presidency. Few presidents have so thoroughly enjoyed popular admiration as did Teddy Roosevelt. Already a hero of the Spanish-American War, he was also known as a naturalist of merit, a big game hunter, a skilled cowboy, and an astute politician. During the years he filled the unexpired term of McKinley, Roosevelt continued his predecessor's policies. In 1904, he was nominated by the Republican Party and beat Alton B. Parker, the Democratic nominee, by 1.5 million votes. On the eve of his inauguration, Roosevelt said to a friend, "Tomorrow I shall come into my office in my own right. Then watch out for me." The next 4 years were busy and exciting ones, both for Roosevelt and for the nation. He mediated the end of the Russo-Japanese War. He kept on crusading against the corporation trusts and always abided by his own slogan, "Don't flinch, don't foul, hit the line hard." A prominent Englishman, on a visit to America, remarked that the two most amazing things he saw here were Niagara Falls and the President, both wonders of nature. If Teddy Roosevelt had wanted to remain president in 1908, he could have received the nomination without a contest. But he'd spoken out 4 years earlier against the possibility of a third term for himself, and he announced that under no circumstances would he be a candidate for renomination. In choosing his successor, Roosevelt selected the man whom he addressed in his letters as "Dear Old Fellow," William Howard Taft. Taft, with his rotund figure and infectious chuckle, was an old friend of Roosevelt's and had acted as a sort of roving troubleshooter for the president, going all over the world on special missions for him. His friendliness and humility were great assets. Everyone liked him. He also had proved that he was an able administrator when he served as America's first governor of the Philippines and later as Secretary of War. The Democrats turned again to their old warhorse, William Jennings Bryan, this time with a progressive platform. Both candidates had announced at the outset that they would not indulge in political barnstorming, but habit was too much for Bryan. Public speaking was almost as vital to him as the 6 meals he ate every day, and by mid-August of the election year, he was making the rounds of the nation's railroad depots with the energy and enthusiasm of a switch engine. Win or lose, there was nothing he loved as much as being one of the two most important men in the country. But Taft, remembering Roosevelt's advice, smiled his way into the hearts of the voters and won them with speeches like this one on peace.
I am willing to admit that war has accomplished much in the progress of the world. I'm willing to admit that there are certain crises in the forward march of Christian civilization that perhaps could not have been met in any other way than by the sword. I'm willing to admit that war develops certain heroic traits in men and furnishes a test for the evidence of the highest character. It's the great mass of the plain people that Lincoln loved so well that have to stand the brunt of war. They do not have the glory of coming home with the gold lace and the feathers and all that falls to the leader. They are not elected presidents because they happen to be successful. They know the demoralization that follows in the wake of war. We should lead the way, and all doubts as to our constitutional authority should be resolved in favor of our stepping forward as a nation with the power, the wealth, the fortune, and the opportunity that God has given us to help along the movement of Christian progress toward permanent peace.
Taft won the election with a total of 321 electoral votes to Bryan's 162. It was the worst defeat of Bryan's 3 campaigns for the presidency, and it was his last. Teddy Roosevelt packed up his high-powered rifles and went on a big game hunt to Africa, leaving Taft on his own. It was a time of political and social turmoil, and perhaps Taft was not the man to cope with the problems that soon arose. He was conscientious, but the Republican Party had split, largely due to his abandonment of Roosevelt's policies. Upon his return to America, Roosevelt was disappointed by Taft's performance in the White House, and their friendship came to an end. In the 1912 election, Taft was again the Republican candidate, and Roosevelt broke away from his former political ties to form a new party. His real name was the Progressive Party, but Roosevelt remarked to reporters one day that he was feeling as strong as a bull moose, and from that moment on, the third party was known as the Bull Moose Party. The Democratic candidate that year was Woodrow Wilson, New Jersey's governor. The ensuing campaign was a contest of personalities, a fight between the placid Taft, the clear-thinking Wilson, and the hard-hitting Roosevelt, who said,
"The difference between Mr. Wilson and myself is fundamental. The other day, in a speech at Sioux Falls, Mr. Wilson stated his position when he said that the history of government, the history of liberty, was the history of the limitation of governmental power. This is true as an academic statement of history in the past. It is not true as a statement affecting the present. It is true of the history of medieval Europe. It is not true
of the history of 20th century America. Mr. Wilson stands for the liberty of the oppressor to oppress. We stand for the limitation of his liberty, thus to oppress those who are weaker than himself.
An unexpected excitement in an already dramatic presidential race came when Roosevelt was shot by an anti-third term fanatic in Milwaukee. Both the other candidates suspended their campaigns until Roosevelt recovered. His injury was not serious, as the bullet had been deflected by his spectacle case. Wilson won the election, carrying 40 out of the 48 states. It meant the end of the Bull Moose Party. Roosevelt said, "The fight is over. We are beaten. There is only one thing to do, and that is to go back to the Republican Party. You can't hold a party like the Progressive Party together." Wilson's administration brought new ideas to Capitol Hill. He was, for instance, the first president since Thomas Jefferson to appear before Congress in person to deliver a message. His departure from tradition signified a new era in politics. Thunderclouds of war were already rolling in Europe, and Wilson issued a series of neutrality proclamations stating that the United States would keep out of Europe, though he had the foresight to strengthen our military and naval forces. In 1916, when he became a candidate for a second term, he was hailed as having kept the nation out of war. As he said in one of his campaign speeches that year,
"I remember reading of a great day in the year 1775, when certain farmers took their guns in their hands and gathered in little groups along the road that led from Lexington in Massachusetts to Boston. And there quietly lay, in order to intercept British troops who had come upon an errand aimed at the liberties of the colonies. And I've often heard since that day men speak of the embattled farmers at Lexington. Well, there are going to be embattled farmers again in the history of this country, not with guns in their hands, but with ballots in their hands, who are going to come back and claim the sovereignty which they share with the rest of the people of the United States. I do not wish anything I say to be understood as embattling the farmers against any other great legitimate interest in this country, because our task at the present moment is the task of understanding one another so thoroughly that there will be only one cause, only one purpose, and men acting together can lift all the levels of our political life."
Wilson's opponent was Charles Evans Hughes, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court and former Governor of New York. Wilson made few appearances during the campaign on the grounds that the president should stay on his job during those troubled times. Hughes carried on a vigorous campaign of speechmaking all over the country, but Wilson won the election and immediately faced one of the most difficult terms of office a president has known. The United States entered World War I in April of 1917, and during the first months of the war, Wilson reached the height of his popularity. Under his leadership, the American people were completely unified in a common cause for the first time in generations. When the war was over, Wilson's famous 14 points to a fair and just peace were ignored by the Allied prime ministers, and in the end, he succeeded in establishing only one of his points, the realization of his dream, the League of Nations. Ironically, his own country failed to support the League, and Wilson, ill and embittered, spent the last months of his term in almost complete seclusion.